Hey listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. Today we're excited to have James Alexander, the first hire of the Trust and Safety team for Wikimedia Foundation. James also has worked as Global Head of Safety Platform Tools and Support for Twitter's Trust and Safety Department. Here are some of the questions we answer in today's episode. Who is liable for AI-generated content? How does Section 230 affect AI? Why does AI have no copyright? How will negotiations play out between platforms and the companies building AI models? Why do the Spider-Man multiverse movies exist? What did it look like to be the first trust and safety worker at Wikipedia? And what does fact-checking look like at Wikipedia? As a reminder, the views stated in this episode are not affiliated with any organization and only represent the views of the individuals. We hope that you enjoy the show.
Hey, James. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, for sure. Let's get right into it. Specifically, I wanted to ask you this. When OpenAI deploys a model and gives it to an enterprise, and now that enterprise uses that model, fine-tunes it, and say there's like some downstream user that's using this model or using some output of this model. Let's take an example here. Let's say OpenAI makes a model and Facebook is using this model. From this model, there's like some Facebook generative AI use case. Who owns that liability?
So the short answer is it depends on the contract that OpenAI or the company providing the model and Facebook or the company consuming the model has. And to a lesser degree, the contract between the end company and the consumer who might have in the terms of service saying, oh, it's your decision of what you make. I think in practice, the short answer for there is Facebook's going to own the liability. And if they want to go back and fight with OpenAI, they can, like in that context, like the, especially when they're making changes to it. But even when, like a lot of this is the stuff we go through now. Like if you take an AI machine to help write your customer service email, to help respond to the customer service email, you're still responsible for what you said to that customer. The customer, from both a legal perspective, but also from the perspective of the customer, they're going to say, you sent me this email that told me X. If X is wrong, that liability lies with who sent the email and the company that is responsible for that, signing it. You're required to be saying who's sending it, who's responsible in emails and stuff like that. And it's going to be the same thing for a lot of the places where we use it, because automation and AI aren't really new. We've just gotten much better at it over the past year or two. And it ends up being the same idea of if you've hired a large BPO or a large vendor to respond to a lot of things, if they're sending a huge amount of emails on your behalf, and like usually you give them templates or you tell them what to say, but sometimes they have the ability to adjust it. If they send the wrong message or if they say something that they shouldn't say, you're liable for that. Now, your contract may allow you to go back and challenge that, or you may want to go back and challenge and recoup money from your vendor, even if your contract doesn't say that, because you say that they didn't provide what they promised, just like you could for any service. But that's going to end up being your liability as the person using the product. And that's especially true when you started adding in your own creative work on it. OpenAI right now has the owner's liability for the stuff that they are making through ChatGPT and things like that. And they're certainly going to, just like we always have, try to make sure that we are putting in liability for generated content to the person generating it as much as we can. It's the same reason 230 is so important for user-generated content, that you want to shift liability away from yourself to the creator, to the person who's using it. That's where AI generated content is interesting, is because there is definitely some aspect of multiple creators, the AI itself, but also anybody putting in input into it and creating there. But if you want to use it to do a business process, if you had liability for the business process originally, you have liability for the business process afterwards.
I wanted to pin down a bit on Section 230 here.
Yeah.
So 230 is up in the air for generative AI UGC at this point, whether the clause will apply. What's your take on the situation here?
There's a lot with actual AI generated content. There's a lot of questions there that I'll say up front that hasn't been judged in the court of law. And that goes into, once you start getting into copyright, it is like copyright is one of the most foreseeable ones. If you're not thinking about how you're going to defend yourself in court while you're making an AI for generated content, you should have. and I think whether it stands with 230 depends a lot on where the creativity is lying and where that's going. Because 230 does not completely eliminate the risk on the company. It's putting the risk on where the generation was created and who created it. Mm-hmm. And that's where what it becomes really important from there, because it was created because long ago, before 230, the only things that existed that was close by was either you were a publisher and you didn't have liability for something that your journalist wrote, as long as you were allowing them to release whatever they wanted. So say you were just printing it and letting it go, like it's not your fault that you printed it, the newspaper editor was the one responsible. Or you had total responsibility because you were the editor, you were the writer, you wrote it, you edited it, you have complete authority over what goes there. And the court said, you as a user-generated platform have to decide. Either you do no moderation, no adjustment, and therefore you can be a publisher only, and the person who created the content is responsible. Or you're going to go editing and choosing what's allowed on the platform and not. And in that case, if you decide not to edit, to moderate something, or you decide to allow something, you're responsible for it. 230 said, hey, it's everything's growing, there's a lot happening, you can moderate without the worry that you missed something or that you made a choice somewhere else. The person responsible is the person who wrote it. Not nobody. Somebody's responsible. If somebody's going to say a horrible thing or do something illegal, they're responsible for that. But you as the company are not going to be responsible for it. When AI comes in place, I think the starting spot is the same thing there, but then the fight is how much creativity was added in there. And that might be different for things like copyright versus liability and responsibility. If you are able to give a prompt to the AI and say, I want a letter that says that Talha is a horrible person, and then Talha sues me for it, I think you have a very good argument that the person who sat there and wrote, I want a letter that says Taha is a horrible person, is the one responsible for that, not AI. Now, from an AI standpoint and from a company standpoint, you may want to make that a lot harder to happen to protect yourself so that you don't get secondary liability, which will be a risk here, is that sometimes, just like in any trust and safety world, your world is to provide resources and make it safe for the customer, safe for the user, give them power and control, but also to protect the company. And they might do something stupid, but if we've done all we can to make that stupidity less often, or to make sure that they know that they're the one doing something stupid, then they're going to be the one liable. And we can point and say, hey, we did our best. We tried to prevent this. They worked their way around our protections and still did something stupid. If we knew that was a risk and didn't take that action, we might get a secondary liability there and have to defend that and protect that.
Yeah. What does the nature of the secondary liability look? For example, right, as we know, it led to this generation of social media algorithms, which, for better or for worse, may or may not have led to the rampant depression in Gen Z, right? In that way, we allowed the companies to amplify what they wanted to amplify and de-amplify what they wanted to de-amplify. Whether that's political polarization, that's like a whole other thing. And we can get a bit into that too, if you want today. My question is if we also let 230 apply to generative AI, does that also just completely shift the liability from the company to the 100% to the user? Or is there a mechanism such that the company can be incentivized to do these trust and safety measures as well.
Yeah. I think, and we don't have the right, we don't have specific on-point laws and regulations right now for this. I think that you can extrapolate a little bit from other laws and from other places. I think the right way to do it and to incentivize it is to have some level of regulation that requires people to put safeguards in place. Ideally, I would say that should be self-regulation. That should be users coming together, the companies coming together, saying what they're going to do, writing it down in their policies. We already have, in the US, we already have spot regulations where if you say you're going to do something in your privacy policy, like a privacy policy is not required for many companies. It is for some companies under certain laws. But if you write in your privacy policy, you're going to do X and don't do it, the FCC can come after you and say, you didn't follow your rules. You said you were going to do something. And now that's actually a consumer protection issue because we didn't tell you you were not allowed to share that data. You said you wouldn't share that data, but then you did share that data. And we can now actually enforce that on you. We can enforce your own policy. That's where the self-regulation comes in place in the US, is that once you've written down that I'm going to do X, you can actually be held legally liable for doing X.
So which agency would hold you legally liable for a harassment policy or something like that?
It is FTC. FTC.
FTC would come after you. Okay.
Trade Commission. Because the idea is that it's a consumer protection question. There also are there are primary privacy regulator right now in the US. They do a lot of that, actually, because if you're not following your privacy policy, they can sue you for that and say that
you're screwing over your consumer. That makes sense. So that any type of self-regulation that's imposed by the company on itself, if they do not follow their own, it's like a false advertisement bid nature of fraud. So I guess my question then to you is why a self-regulation and not a federally mandated regulation?
Honestly, I think that's better because the industry is changing a lot. Things change quickly. Governments are really slow to change. And it's really hard to write concrete guidelines that can't adjust. Like the ad industry, for example, mostly self-regulates and has very strict regulations that if you're part of the ad agency's sort of industry groups, you have to follow. And then the FTC can enforce those because everybody's agreed to follow those rules.
So are you saying basically you need the industry to get to a point where the competitive nature of the competing companies want to regulate themselves and then basically report each other?
Yeah, to a certain degree, but also they want to regulate themselves so that they're not regulated as highly by the government, because the government will always do something wrong. Not because they're intending to, but they're going to write policies and expectations based on their understanding and based on specifics that exist right now, which is harder. And I think that in order to stay within our what we want to do is incentivize safeguards and not incentivize no safeguards. And so like some of our existing rules could be interpreted as incentivizing no safeguard, because that's the way to get around a 230 issue is just be a publisher. I wrote an AI model. I gave you the AI model. You did silly things with it. I didn't have any protections in it. I let you do whatever you wanted in it. And so it is your responsibility of what you actually did into it. Because there's a risk that if I did some things, like maybe I made it harder for you to create CSAM or pornography, but I didn't put any restrictions on hate content and hate text. Now I have a risk there because I did put restrictions in, but chose not to do restrictions for another type of bad content. Maybe because that was really hard. It may not have been because I actually wanted that or was okay with that. It may have just been it was much easier to do the other restrictions. But now I'm at risk here if I don't have something like 230. Now, I think you could argue for 230 for the same reasons, you want to be able to put in as many restrictions as you can, because that's better for you as a company. Because yes, there is a legal and a regulatory reason, and you want to protect yourself from legal liability. But also, if your platform is making lots of horrible content, then you're going to just have bad PR, and that can be even worse. So you have it, you already have a reason to put in protections, but you don't want a legal reason like pushing against that.
But doesn't that get us basically to the point we are today? So for example, if we were there 10 years ago and Facebook's like starting up again, maybe 12 years ago, whatever, who uses Facebook still? But anyways, Facebook's starting up again and we're governing it. We're saying like, let's let it self-govern. Let's give it 230 protection because the liability should fall on whoever has creative control of the content, not necessarily on the publisher. But I would argue that to a certain extent, the algorithm is creative control too, and a certain set of liability should fall back onto the platform. But my point being is that Facebook and other social media companies, even if they do band together to report on each other, their collective gain theoretical interest is it's a Nash equilibrium to not report each other for engagement. Because at the end of the day, engagement will increase retention will increase monetization in the long run.
Yeah.
My point being is if we're in the same space, we're seeing this again now with short form video, right? Short form video is fragmenting and I don't even have the option to not have the short form content on my platform. So for example, YouTube, there should be some legal regulation on the platform that doesn't force me to eventually start scrolling there too, right? And it's hard to foresee these risks, right? Like maybe 15 years ago, we couldn't say that the biggest problem of social media, besides maybe misinformation campaigns, but one of the bigger problems is the attention mining. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can't forecast that problem, but something isn't sitting right for me, at least. And maybe I'm also like a lot less informed about you on this, but something isn't sitting right that the generative AI companies are not getting some form of pass back liability.
I think you're probably right. And I think that is one of the big missing points there and how to have some of that liability without giving all of it is the tough part. Cause I don't think that they should or do under at least US constitutional expectations have all of that. I think it would be bad. Nobody's going to create the AI that can be changing and be really open if they're going to have all of the liability for what's being used outside of it. There is two sides of the AI question that are important to think about separately. So there's something like ChatGPT that is a consumer-facing product, but is really created as a demo. Like they talk of it as a beta. They're obviously adjusting it. But really, it's to show you how cool the system is and to make you think about it. The real uses for AI are in many ways expanding on what we've always wanted to do and always done to a certain degree. We've been trying to have chatbots for customer service for more than a decade now. Like AOL had chatbots that tried to do customer service to a certain degree, not perfectly, but they worked. Like same thing for AI and different machine learning models to try to decide how to rank trust and safety reports, so how to proactively flag or take down content. We've been trying to do that for a long time. The biggest question for liability, like those are two separate questions for liability. Like you have the ChatGPT generatively creating content. You have, and like on the flip side of that, you have something like Stable Diffusion or an open model that nobody doesn't have a tie to it, which has its own complications that we could get into. But then the vast majority of the liability in the question is actually going to be on the commercial use of it. And if OpenAI creates a model that Facebook uses, this is where Facebook is getting that liability for their use of that model. And probably should, but they are going to be hugely incentivized to be demanding a good product from OpenAI and to be having contracts and expectations to hold that liability in check and to have SLAs and expectations, just like we would if we're hiring a lot of BPO agents and content moderators, or if we're just hiring an ML model that will rank images. If they're really bad and suddenly say that the surprise Pikachu is terrorist content and takes it all down, we're going to be really unhappy and we're going to be responsible for that. But we're also going to go back to the model creator and be like, what would you do? How do we fix this? When you want to make a consumer-facing model and a consumer-facing product like ChatGPT, you have some liability there. At least I think you should. I think you could argue at the moment 230 would give you less of that. But you're right. The reason that's a big argument and would have to go into court is because there's a lot of creative influence coming in from the machine itself at that point, which is fed from so many people. I would tell you, and I've been a nerd on copyright for a long time, I would tell you that anything that the AI is creating has essentially no copyright, personally. Unless you're getting far enough along down the line of adding a lot of input in and a lot of not just a sentence or a prompt, but readjusting and getting it. Maybe if you get really far down, you could get to the idea of AI generated or AI assisted art and get your own copyright there. But that just sitting there and writing something on ChatGPT and getting paragraphs back from it, or going to DALL-E and sending and putting in a prompt and getting a picture, there's no copyright there. I will say that, and then say you could argue that you have 230's protection still, but those are somewhat in conflict.
I see your point. So you're saying that if the platform is getting 230 protection, that's basically saying that the content generated is the user is making it, therefore the user should have intellectual property over the content. However, if the platform doesn't have 230 protection, then they should own
some
portion. I see.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And that's where something like 230 was created expecting a lot more input creatively from the person writing the content or making the image or video or uploading it, making a choice. Yeah. There's no question that if somebody takes something from ChatGPT or takes an image from DALL-E and then uploads it to Threads and posts it out, they now have liability. They decided to put that photo out there in the world. They have liability for that decision and the publication of that, which means that if you have a private conversation, you have a lot less liability. You have a very good protection. They could have chosen not to post that on Threads. That was their choice to do that. If they looked at it and said, this is a horrible image or this is a horrible paragraph, they could have not used it. Now, you might have liability to them for having seen a horrible image or having to read a horrible paragraph. But the multiple level steps there of them now having to share it is much less. Now, if you publicly, like Stable Diffusion and a couple others, there's a lot of times where some of the AI systems will automatically make things public. There you have some liability there, because to a certain degree, you published it. You made that choice. You have to make sure you can get reports, take it down. And that's where...
You as in the company.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Where because it was made privately and then shared ChatGPT or something like that, there's a lot less of a risk there from a, I think, like 230 standpoint. Like, you've clearly given them the ability... They've made that creative choice of sharing it, etc.
I wanted to ask a bit about why you're saying that AI has no copyright. Is that just because there is, and earlier you said that the onus of liability is going to fall on whoever is exerting more creativity onto the artifact that's being generated. Yep. So that my question there then is, why would Adobe, some type of Photoshop, What's the principal distinction between a Photoshop image and a Midjourney image?
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing is, and again, this is where we don't have great law. So you have to go through of the stuff that we do know. For example, there have been lots of good cases of an animal taking a photo, taking your camera, taking a photo themselves. And the animals under U.S. copyright do not have the ability to have copyright. They don't exist. But they took the photos.
We should change that.
As a Wikipedian, I refuse Absolutely. Peter did sue, trying to say that the monkey who did the monkey selfie deserved the copyright.
I don't know. I'm still team Harambe all these years later.
But that's our standing law right now, is that they don't. And same thing, there is actually cases about saying that a machine making something doesn't create copyright. The machine, if the machine chose to swipe left when they were making a painting versus swiping right, that was the machine's choice. Even though you may have programmed in lots of options, that has dispersed a lot of that. With AI, it becomes even more complicated, partially just because where did that come from? Like, you taught it frequently with lots of other people's copyright, which opens up a whole nother copyright can of worms.
We'll get there. Don't worry.
But because, like, the machine is learning this and deciding what it wants to do based on lots and lots of inputs, all of which are de minimis. They're all tiny to the contribution of what the decision was in the end. And so there's nobody who really has all of that. Now, maybe if you made a model that was trained off one artist, you could maybe make an argument that artist has some of that copyright, but there's still going to be the code. There's still going to be a lot of randomization in there. There's still going to be a lot of decisions that no human had input in. And right now our law says, if you're not a human, you don't have copyright.
Interesting. Okay.
Or a company, but companies are humans.
What? Yeah, sure. Anyways, that's not today. I guess I do have somewhat of a follow-up there then. Is prompt engineering considered creative control?
I think that is an interesting debate that's going to have to happen. Because I think there is a potential for a lot of creativity to be involved there. And that is a reasonable argument. I would personally say, I don't think so. I think it's creative. I think you are a creative doing that. But I think under our current expectations and understandings of how we deal with copyright, there's still going to be too much randomization, too much out of your control to get there. I think that if you get it to enough of a point, it's a reasonable argument. It's something that I would tell them to go sue. I tell them to try to get to make that, but you don't always want to. I'll be interested because, of course, you always run the risk of losing. You don't want to run a court. You don't want to do a lawsuit that creates history, that creates case law that goes against you. So you want to pick a really good case. You want to pick one that you really got it down to exactly how you wanted it to. But like right now, that's not really the case at most spots. Like maybe if you got the exact seed and you tried everything, but then you basically just tried everything. Like you're just giving them replication materials, copying it.
I don't know if I have a strong opinion there. I was just thinking about like the politics of it in the long run. So like in theory, let's say over the next 10 years, prompt engineering becomes more and more of a occupation. Yeah. Do they have power? How are they capturing power? And if they get enough organization and or power, will they be able to sway?
Yeah. I think it is one of those spots.
Creative?
Yeah. I think it is one of those spots where I'm not sure I know the right answer long term. Like my opinion on it right now is probably more a question of like how we currently think of copyright and how we currently do it. I am somebody who is a copyright minimalist overall. I prefer less copyright because I think that's better for innovation. Like the point of copyright is supposed to be a short-term option to encourage you to innovate. But like all music, all writing is based on other people's music, other people's writing. And so you still want that to be able to be used and iterated on and innovated from. Right now, we have really long copyright for 85 plus years.
Yeah, thank you, Disney.
Thank you, Disney. Thank you, Sonny Bono. Like it's Disney's going to come up soon. There are protections for trademarks. There are other options. Mickey Mouse is not going to suddenly not apply to Disney when it goes out of copyright next year. I think it's next year. But right now, I don't want you getting too much copyright because I think that's going to be bad for innovation and bad for restriction. Like trying to copyright a small sentence, right now we don't allow you to copyright a sentence. Like even just in general, it's just too short. It's just too simple. It's a lot harder. And it's one of the reasons I don't think code is usually particularly copyrightable. There's arguments there. There are people who disagree with
it. Why wouldn't code be copyrightable?
Because it's setting, it's instructions aren't copyrightable either. Like in general, like if I give you like the instruction manual of like how to use something or do A, do B, do C, that's not copyrightable because it's not considered artistic in that sense. It's considered like instructional and procedural. But the same reason we have similar rules for weird. You can't actually copyright a sneaker because it's considered just an important, like it's considered just a usable thing. And Nike and folks agree on that. There's somebody who was printing Nike shoes using a 3D printer and people were like, oh, you should sue. And Nike was like, nah, it's not copyrightable. It's not, because as far as they're concerned, that's a good thing because then they can steal things from Adidas and you can have trade secrets. You can have other things, but you can put patents in at times. But like there's reasons not to use the patents and copyright don't work even for the design of something. This is a new world. We have to think through what that means.
Yeah, from what I'm getting, if I'm going to be somewhat reductionist here.
Yeah.
It's almost as if how much agency was used on an individual to create the artifact or the output. Mm-hmm. And that's determining whether it's copyrightable, patentable, IP, whatever, mm-hmm. protection, whatever intellectual property protection you want to call it.
Yeah.
I guess my point is if generative AI is, if you're prompt engineering and you're, let's say it's like a 3-page essay in mm-hmm. order to prompt engineer and every sentence is a stroke on the painting.
Yeah.
I don't know. That doesn't sound wrong that in the current system, maybe you should be able to copyright it. Now, whether copyright should exist or not, or whether it should only be like 17 years instead of like 87 or whatever it is, that's a whole other discussion. Mm-hmm. But in the current system, it's almost saying that there's a threshold for the amount of effort necessary to copyright something. And if it's the case that this is someone's profession and the amount of effort continuously increases, mm-hmm. it would continuously increase in a certain way. Overall, the effort should decrease if you're using generative AI, but if the profession expands or whatever you want to call it and starts increasing and it passes that threshold of copyrightable, that doesn't seem like an unplausible outcome to me.
I think that's possible. I think that's where it will become a question of what do we want and what is the interpretation there. As I said, like right now, instructions aren't copyrightable. You might be able to copyright the design of your user manual, but the like actually how to do something is not. Like the steps aren't. And even a very long prompt is likely basically trying to refine telling the system how to make something. It's make a man standing up wearing a shirt that is blue. Like, they'll have to refine it exactly, but they're essentially trying to do that. Whether that's copyrightable now, I'd say probably not. That doesn't mean it's not what we want. If we decide that this is really important, this is really skilled work, and that it should be, then we can pass laws. We can change it. We can make a choice as a society that is really important. But we also have to make sure that's what we want. Is the prompt the thing that's important? Is it the output that's really important? Is it the use of the output? You can still get protection for taking that image you made and putting it on a shirt. You can get some other protections there most likely, whether for your trademark or for a design of the shirt and how you're doing it. But we have to balance those right now. Current rules, I think, say most of it wouldn't get copyright.
But in like, let's say you're graphic designing a t-shirt, right? Let's say you print it through whatever, custom ink or something like that.
Yeah.
Essentially, you're giving instructions to a machine. What's the distinction there?
Yeah. And that is why when you're giving instructions to a machine to custom ink or something like that, the copyright applies to whatever you were giving them. And because you were trying to get them to make a photo like to not make it shirt. Look like. And so the copyright for that photo is still whoever owned the copyright of the photo earlier. It's the same thing if you're trying to, the weird law, for example, right now, if it's a statue, it's like a 3D statue, and you take a photo of a 3D statue, you have copyright in your photo, but also the copyright of the statue carries out, but because there is the copyright in the statue, but you have special copyright because you're trying to like, you have to decide whether, how you wanted to put the photo, how you wanted to do that. Do you want to get this side versus the other side? But if you want to take a 2D painting and you just want to get a really good photograph of that painting and make sure that painting, it comes across in that photo, that's a really hard job to do that really well. You got no copyright in that photo though. Because like your entire point for that photo was to carry over that painting, the copyright's the paintings. And that means if the painting had no copyright because it was 200 years old, your photo has no copyright. If that copyright still had paint, it was new, was painted 10 years ago, the painter has the copyright into your photo. Because that's where that artistic freedom came from. Even though it was not easy for you to take that photo, it's not effort necessarily. It's really hard to write code, but it is basically just instructions to the computer. And so under our current rules, that usually would be said not to have copyright.
Could you, in theory, circumvent that and call the code a quote-unquote essay, and then the essay gets sent to Custom Ink, which is your compiler, and then that becomes instructions?
Under case law, yeah. No. I'm sure somebody's tried that. They certainly, obviously the main argument has always been, and it's not, like there are some disagreements in areas, like not everybody agrees with me on this, but I think in general the code has said, there is the case recently with, not that recently, a couple years ago now, but Google and Adobe and like the API and how API ended up not being copyrightable. They couldn't do that because it was just instructions. It was just code that was being sent in. And so it didn't matter if they copied it or not anymore, because that was what it was, because they were allowed to. And if it's copyrightable, then you have the debate of, did you copy it? Did you make it up all on your own? Did you redo it all on your separately? But if it's not, it doesn't matter if you copied it.
Yeah, it struck me in a weird way that the reason API is not copyrightable is because it's code. But I feel like there's 10 other reasons why it shouldn't be copyrighted, and that was the wrong reason to choose. But I guess that's...
Yeah. Doesn't mean the others don't apply either. And that's part of it. That may just be the easiest one. Courts will always choose the easy way out because they should. Like they don't have to make a decision on the other three options if they can find one. Mm-hmm. Because then you're just shutting yourself out for later. You don't want to make a decision based on bad cases. It's the same reason the Supreme Court normally and normally does. If they don't have to make a ruling on the case, they won't. They'll be like, hey, the case doesn't matter anymore. You already settled. You already made a decision. Or the law has now been reversed. And so I don't need to say whether the law was constitutional because it doesn't exist anymore. It allows you that choice, that option there. Don't want to constitutional avoidance. Don't make a decision you don't have to.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that somewhat makes sense to me. But that's a whole other digression. Yeah. I wanted to go back a bit to the images that are fed into the generative AI model, the images and the text, the copyrighted, or maybe not copyrighted, general UGC that's on the internet. So actually, what you said earlier was super fascinating about Section 230 versus copyright. So I'll use that as an example to jump off of. Let's say Facebook is training these, it's also training these large language model competitors. It's open source Llama 2. Llama 2 being the ChatGPT for Facebook. Anyways, my point being, if Facebook is saying that its content should be able to be bypassed by Section 230, or its liability, it shouldn't have any liability from Section 230, does it then have the ability to train the models on another person's creative content?
So I think the training the models on another person's creative content is a separate conversation from the 230 question.
But it's similar, right? I remember you were saying that if you're saying generative AI, the same principle applies. You're saying 230 bypasses generative AI, then it's the case that the creative control falls back onto the user of the ChatGPT or the chatbot.
Yeah. And I think they're related in that, especially like partially because it's being trained on so many things, that makes the idea that the model itself is making lots of decisions a stronger one, which then hurts 230 questions. And because each individual person's contribution to it ends up being so small, relatively speaking. I think there is a separate conversation there that is a little bit separate from 230, but is the just what is the allowance to use all of that content? Like right now, you like the internet doesn't change the copyright of something. If you wrote an essay on the internet, you still own the copyright unless you released it. You may have released it under a license because of the terms of service or because you chose to. But if you post it on your own blog that's publicly available to anybody, you own that copyright. You're giving people the ability to read it, but they can't republish it. They can't reuse it other than under the license that you've given. Same thing for a painting or an image that's posted online. The copyright still exists for those paintings and for those images. There is a big question then for large language models and large models in general, that what happens to that copyright? If I'm an artist and you take all of my art and feed it in there, do I get something from that? What control do I have from that? And there has been there's a feeling of people who have grown up on the internet, and I have this myself to a certain degree, of everything's just available, everything's just there. That hasn't changed the rules, though. The fact that you can access it does not mean you have the ability to use it and put it on your own t-shirt and sell it and make money from it and put it in. There is...
But you can digest it.
That is a question that is not answered. And that's where it goes. There are lawsuits now. It will be a question that has to get answered.
You can read five different blog posts, synthesize it into your own information and contribute and write something that's usually with creative control. Why can't the AI do the same thing? Yeah.
Yeah. And that will be the argument. But the question is at scale, as like where, and even there, you have to be very careful. So Wikipedia, for example, has always thought really hard about this, because it's really hard to read five sources and then not copy the source when you're writing an article. It's a fair bit of effort, but can be done to creatively then write an article that is in your own words, not in somebody else's words, and is sourced to somewhere else. But obviously it's something that's done all the time. That's why it's so important, because everything is a riff off what existed before. Like every time somebody gets sued as a musician because, you're using the same riff in the background, there is a very finite number of good pop riffs. That's just what it is. At least that people want to hear and people want to listen. You can still remix that. You can still use that. You can still do a lot of new content on top of that. But you're going to repeat. And so that's just the reality. Otherwise, we're stuck and we're not innovating. We're not changing. Now, I think that there is a very good argument for text of reading and reusing text. It's not a perfect argument. It hasn't gone through the courts necessarily, but I think that that is, as you said, like you read seven articles and then you come up with your own article. That's a reasonably good argument. I think that's much harder with paintings. It's much harder with art, and it's much harder depending on what you're using it for.
So what changes in the modality? Why is text different than image?
Because it's a lot easier to see the copying and the change, I think, in art and images. And there's a lot more, it also is where there's a lot of like in the style type questions of if I'm painting a new piece of art using AI that is in the style of somebody else, but the only reason I can do it in the style of somebody else is because all of their copyrighted material was given into my model. That's a tough moral argument to make, that they don't own some copyright there. Now, you can make an argument that's not unreasonable, that if I say write a new blog post in the style of a famous journalist, write this blog post in the style of Casey Newton. There's an argument to be made there that I'm stealing some copyright from that aspect. But I think it's a less reasonable argument, both from a sort of how people think of that, from like, which is important because how laws work in the end is a lot on just what people think is right. Because you can always change the law. And that's weird. How laws work in the short term is based on how the law is written. How laws work in the long term is how people write the laws. And I think that the textual analysis, because you end up, copyright applies generally to the text. But for images, there's a lot of like style and how things work.
Yeah, it reminds me of like earlier we were talking about the other side of it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more creative control. And where there's more creative control, there's more room for, I guess it's the same principle, right? More room for, I don't know, more room for copyright, more room for creativity.
I think that's so. Yeah. And like it comes down to, take the devil's advocate of myself there. At its core, part of the problem is people having to learn how to understand what they want out of the machine and like what, and yes, how much creativity is that, but what is the difference? And it comes from that question of who can have copyright. Is it just a human? If you want, lots of people would talk about it. It's a neural network. It's a model. If you looked at 1,000 paintings and drew a new painting in the style of the person that made that 1,000 paintings, there is no question you're allowed to do that. Now, if you stroke for stroke copied it, maybe not. But like in practice, you can't do that as a human. But you absorbed all that information and then made your own out of style. And that, there's almost no question you're allowed to do. Under our current rules, though, the idea of putting that all into a robot that then has the perfection, is able to really make it as good as possible. Where does that lie? Similar to that, taking a photo of the painting and the copyright belongs to the painter, not to you. If all of the photos go into a model, but then creates a new painting, who owned the copyright?
Yeah, this had a really random tangent thought from what you were saying. It's kind of like, even when like calculus was being developed from Newton and the other guy, it's that the science was being developed in two places concurrently.
Yeah.
And I guess my point is that art does this a lot too, is that we only label movements when you're like 50 or 100 years in the future, and we see a lot of the people mimic each other. So that's one random aside. I don't really know how that applies in this case, but that, so maybe it's the case that if a machine is part of that movement, is that a problem? Maybe that's the application of that thought.
Yeah. I think that's definitely the argument. The argument is to say that the machine is just another human absorbing it and putting it out, just as if a human could.
Currently, we have a rule that doesn't, it only allows humans to have copyright. So then if we've already made that distinction of human versus not human in the law, at some point, it seems pretty reasonable to include it somewhere else, whether in how we want the outcome to be.
Yeah. No, agreed. And I think we would, but that's where the flip side of like the input and the copyright in the input takes. Because like it's like in the example of it's just one model trained on my 1,000 paintings, that is a hard argument to say that person who painted those 1,000 paintings doesn't have some level of ability here. Now, of course, in a large language model, and a large, not language in that context, but in a large model, that's thousands of artists and all of their paintings all in one spot. And maybe I pulled in there and said, I want a painting in the style of James Alexander, but they're still painting that painting now with the knowledge of and the context of everybody else's painting.
Yeah.
Which then makes the disconnect on my own copyright harder, but leaves to this question, though, of I didn't give you permission to take all of my paintings. Does it mean I have less painting because you decided – I have less copyright because you decided to take in 100,000 of those paintings? That's the digest question. But that's the digest question. Like, the normal digest thought process is you're allowed to digest it because, like, you were able to view it and you made a choice and you can only do so many. It's not that big of a thing. But if it's a machine, it can go in and just do everything.
Yeah.
And that's – the same, but obviously not really the same. Like, yeah. It's something a human could never do, and so it was never really what people thought of, was thinking about.
Yeah, my gut instinct here is like, we want the artist to also like capture some of the profits that are generated from like the tooling that's being used for their profit. Yep. But like the counter to that is, in do I want a future? We've already fucked this up in the past, right? In the past, we fucked it up by instituting copyright laws to remove creative pieces from the public domain. And now that they're not in the public domain, maybe Spider-Man looks different, right?
Yep.
Or maybe it's a case that, actually, this is a random aside that we can feel free to cut out. But yeah, I was randomly going down this train of thought the other day, but it's, do we get the multiverse movies if they were not in the structure of a capitalist system?
Yeah.
Because we've repeated Spider-Man so many times because Marvel found Spider-Man to be successful, and then they had to recapture it like a bunch of different times, a bunch of different remakes, and then eventually that leads to multiverse, right?
Yeah. It's even weirder. The only reason we have the multiverse movies for Spider-Man is because of a horrible contract. Old Marvel made a really bad contract with Sony that required them to make new movies every couple years or they were going to lose the contract. But importantly, if they made new movies every contract, they would never lose the contract. Every couple of years, they would never lose the contract. Disney would never have signed that contract. It probably made sense for Marvel at the time, who wasn't making movies on their own, just wanted the money, $1 million or whatever it is, it seemed like a great idea. It may have made sense at the time. It is now a horrible contract, but they have no way out of it. And so they had to keep rebooting it, keep doing different things in order to keep the contract. Don't want to sell it to Disney because Disney's they want to keep – that's the only thing Sony has that's making money. And they finally found something that kind of worked because they were never able to make a great Spider-Man movie other than the more recent ones that Disney actually made for them and basically allowed them to keep 90% of the money. Now they like finally found artistic like animation work that is awesome and is different. But yeah, we never would have gotten it if it wasn't for a bad, weird contract. And
We're not cutting this out now. Yeah. But no, I guess my point being that we've already made it such that we've already made like institutions and structures and codes such that you can capture your creative practices in law or whatever.
Yeah.
But now that there's another emerging technology and we have the option of whether we want to continue this practice of copyright or not, both on the ingestion part and on the output part, maybe it's something we want to reconsider our relationship to intellectual property.
Yeah. I think we always have to. Every piece, things change. And one of the reasons I would say we need to reconsider both patent and copyright law in many cases is because things are changing so quickly now, like that there is a big difference than it used to be of how long somebody's around, how quickly innovation is happening. Like the idea of a patent for 30 years doesn't make sense if 30 years from now, nobody wants it anyway. You want it for less time. You need it for a couple of years. You can make a lot of your money in those couple of years. We need to rethink about a lot of these things and how they should apply in the modern era. And we have to make decisions from a cultural standpoint of what does that mean? That's hard. They're not easy decisions. Like I can make an argument in multiple directions. It's just but they are things we have to do because otherwise
we have to make. Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise it just sits around and we use these old hundreds of year old laws to make a decision that not infrequently leads to a less than ideal situation.
Yeah. I haven't properly introduced you to the audience, by the way. So, but anyways, James was the first Wikipedia trust and safety hired. He worked there for 8 years and then was at Twitter for 4 years, right?
Yeah, just over four.
4 years and ran the integrity operations. We'll get to Wikipedia, I promise. And maybe Twitter, maybe not. We've talked about Twitter a lot here. But before that, I do want to ask your opinion on what happens in the long run of the Facebook versus OpenAI contract situation. Yeah. Not when it's just Facebook, but when it's like, first off, it can be the case that it's not just OpenAI and Anthropic and Facebook making these models, but it can be a whole lot of different other players. What happens in the long run of the platforms that are using the model and versus the platform that's not platform, but the company that's making the model.
Yeah.
So over the long run, what happens in the contract negotiations?
Yeah, I think at its base, it's just like a regular vendor conversation. And because they're not new. Like at Twitter, we had long conversations about hiring AI models, ML models. I'm personally a fan. I can't even remember who originally said it, but somebody had the comment of what is AI? And they were like, it's a bad turn of phrase from the 1970s. Is that it's not really artificial intelligence and how we think about artificial intelligence. It's really a large language model. It's really a machine learning model that's been fed. It's really applied statistics. But that those models and the desire for those are new. And so people, whether it's Hive or OpenAI or what, have been creating these models both internally and externally for many years. Some of them are quite good at certain things. At Twitter, a large percentage of our, especially media content, but both, were proactively discovered using different models. Like, rather than waiting for a user who's actually pretty crap at deciding whether or not they want to, whether or not something is against our policy, a model that is trained to see something that's nudity or trained to see something that's violent or trained to see something that's against our policies is much better at that. Not perfect, and so you don't necessarily want to take a direct action. Now that we are getting these huge strides, they will be better and they're better at being trained and we can get to the right spot. But you negotiate the use of that as a product, but also as maintenance. Models degrade. They get worse over time because if they're not getting retrained, if they're not getting adjusted, if they're not getting, maybe the same model can do the same thing, but and repeat itself, but everything is changing around it. What people are expecting, but also what the inputs are, keeps changing. And so you need to keep adjusting to that. You sign a contract with somebody that puts out what they have to give you. For a lot of models, that's a SaaS type solution. So they're also hosting it and maintaining it, but it could be on-prem. It could be its own system. And that will include liability. It'll include the question of who is responsible for that.
How does that, how would that go? That's for the one-on-one use case. I'm assuming over the long run, there'll be a set of standards. How is that going to develop?
I think over time, it will be more and more the user, I think. The person who is using the system that will be responsible for what it does. And that's the same. And I think that's following sort of the normal expectations that we have now. In that if you hire somebody to take an action, in general, the company is responsible for their own employee, so to speak. And so there's hiring an AI instead of an employee and telling them to go do X.
I see.
Now, if you can make an argument if the AI decides to go rogue, that there is liability that might fall back. But usually in the consumer and in the corporate world, that sort of liability that goes backwards is not the liability that the consumer or the company is or the government is trying to attack. So if the employee goes off and does something weird in the scope of their employment, especially something that they were told to go do, the company, like the government or the consumer, is going to come after the company. They're going to be the one responsible, at least together, if not all by itself. Now, the company might be like, I'm going to fire you. You did something stupid. But in most cases, the company is still the one getting responsible for something that happened in its own, as part of its employment. That would be the same thing here. I think in most of these contracts, is they might go back and be like, "I'm never going to use your model again," or "You need to pay me." They might have rules in place that allow that to be, and say, "Hey, if I have a lawsuit about this, you have to pay for the bills, or you have to pay the penalty." You can put that into the contract, but the liability is still on the person using it, whether that's Facebook or whether that's Threads or Twitter or a new product. And I think that's easiest to understand because when it's applied, that like it's a model that decided to take something down. The liability for taking it down is the company, because the company said, "Hey, model, go find things to take down." If the company didn't put enough restrictions on that model, that's the company's fault, like the end user company.
So if we're treating the model as an employee, yeah, does that mean that any type of employee restriction will also apply to the model? So for example, I don't know what the exact scope of the labor laws are, but if, for example, it's like you're using AI for recruitment, you're using AI for workforce
management,
surveillance management, whatever. In that case, does it just fall under the, obviously we don't know the answer, but normatively would it fall? Oh, we do. Okay, go for it.
We do. That's actually a perfect, you hit on a perfect example of it. Like I was using the customer service aspect, but like the HR is a perfect example. We use AI models all the time already in HR to a certain degree to try to screen. At least that's been a thing that like lots of companies have tried. Amazon made its own, but Amazon made its own and messed up on it. Makes sense. Like it took lots and lots of its resumes and fed it to the model and said, "Find me people who I should be hiring and reject people who shouldn't be hiring." But because a high proportion of the model, of the things they sent to that model were white cis men, unsurprisingly, the model started going, "Oh, this is a woman, less likely to be hired," and just downranked and sent it down the model, sent it down the queue. And that, but the person responsible for that was the company, was Amazon. They made a choice here, and like the HR laws in place there said you can't be doing discrimination. It doesn't matter that a model decided to violate that discrimination. The model discriminated, yeah. But the company still discriminated, whether it was done by a human or whether it was done by a model. It was just a lot easier for the model to do it. And you think you can blame a model for that, but you can't. It's also the same reason, and it also goes back to why I'm like skeptical of like a big tech regulator. Because in practice, the real thing to be worried about for AI in the sort of real world is how AI and how tech interacts with everything. You can't have one regulator try to decide how it works in HR and how it works in medicine and how it works in building a car and how it works in electrical power. Like, we have regulators for that because they are unique and discrete, and they need to help decide how things should be applying within industries and within and how it works there. But like by default, the way it applies is it applies. That like if you say you can't discriminate, whether the model discriminated or whether a human discriminated. Whichever one decided not to look at as many women is the one who discriminated, no matter what the reasoning was. You can't blame it on the model. And just like having one company to regulate a conglomerate that has 1,000 different...
You're basically saying it's like a technology. So it's, for example, you're not going to regulate office space, yeah, because office space will lead to car accidents, will lead, yeah, to mismanagement of maybe building codes, of maybe workforce deployment, maybe bias, something like that. But it's a technology, not the application of it.
And that's where you can have some regulations, just like you can have building permits or restrict like local rules on what's allowed in an office space in general to protect people, to be safe. But you're not going to regulate of you need this type of office Like, you're not going to have one company being one, like, local agency being like, this is what you need in a medical office. This is what you need in a manufacturing office. This is what you need. Like, they don't know that's where it's important for somebody who knows what they're doing in medicine to write rules about the security you need at a medical company and to go into a medical office. You need to get those discrete systems. One AI regulator is going to be horrible at regulating AI, because AI isn't ChatGPT. AI is how you use it. That's one way to use generative AI. Like, the real question about AI is, how does it work in our real everyday life? And how does it make things better or worse?
Yeah, okay. I promise, listeners, we're done talking about the legal stuff. So now we're going to pivot right into your experience at Wikipedia. So from what I understand, this is all public information. You guys have your workflow quite publicized out in the open. And it's almost like a federation in that you have sub-Wikipedias, like the English-speaking Wikipedia, maybe some other Wikipedia, and they have their own committees and they have their own active users and communities, and they're the ones determining what rules apply in their specific jurisdiction. And then you at the Wikimedia Foundation are almost like the Supreme Court. So every case that you take isn't necessarily an escalation, but it's an interesting borderline case such that you are changing your codes a little bit. Or maybe it's like a governance thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just put my best guess out there.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty close. Like, it is the vast majority of Wikipedia content moderation, but even policy and enforcement, is done by volunteers at the front line. And as you said, like, it's a federation in that it is a lots and lots of smaller communities. When we think of Wikipedia, frequently what you think of is the English Wikipedia originally, the Wikipedia written in English that is the first on the list when we search from a English web in English country. However, there's a lot of other ones, many of which are really big. There's over 100, I think it's almost 300 language Wikipedias at the moment. I'd have to look it up, but like, some of them are very small. Yeah. Some of them are tiny. They don't have a whole lot of activity on it, but they have, some of them are huge that aren't. The German Wikipedia is enormous. The Spanish Wikipedia is enormous. The French Wikipedia, the Dutch Wikipedia, every European language is really big. There's actually two Arabic Wikipedias, because one's an Egyptian Wikipedia, Egyptian Arabic. One is in more
modern
Eastern.
Modern standard, yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, the Chinese Wikipedia is actually the same Chinese Wikipedia for for simple and traditional. They have a specialized script that converts and allows you to decide how you want.
There's a Unicode. Very cool.
Yeah. Cool. And they all have their own local communities that write their own editorial policies and their own user behavior policies. Now, and then you add on top of that Wikimedia Commons, which is a free image repository that lots and lots of people use, and Wikidata, which is a data-centric structured data repository, both of which are integrated into all the Wikipedias, but also heavily used by others, especially automation. So, like, the vast majority of the things that you're seeing in the sidebar in the knowledge graph for Google are coming from Wikidata or coming from their scripts on Wikipedias. But they may not come from English Wikipedia. They could easily come from German, especially if you're searching in German or the same. But then the foundation is helping to support it. And that includes, obviously, creating the software, creating MediaWiki, which is open source, but needs to be constantly adjusted and maintained. And it has a lot of legal protection, because copyright, but also just angry people, are a huge aspect of the work around the world. Everybody has opinions on how Wikipedia should be run. But that then the safety aspect has underlying policies that stem from, obviously, the terms of use, but that those in-house who are doing trust and safety are trying to deal with the worst of the worst and the things that a volunteer shouldn't have to do. You still want to give them as much control as possible, But obviously, if it's illegal, it needs to come down. But also, if it's just really sensitive, it's really anxiety provoking, you're not making a decision on content. You're making a decision of whether something needs has to be taken down or whether there's like a danger involved. And so like a threat of harm, like say a volunteer could, if somebody edits the article about a school and says the school was blown up on Wednesday at 5 p.m. and like tomorrow's Wednesday, that's something that probably needs to be looked at. Somebody needs to be dealing with that. A volunteer could take that, call the local. And in the past, before I started there, the way that could got handled was either it got removed and nothing happened, or a volunteer looked at that and was really anxious and called the local police of that school and said, hey, somebody on Wikipedia made this threat and said that there's going to be a bombing at the school tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. And obviously the local police look at you over the phone being like, what? Who are you? like one, the volunteer is already incredibly anxious, trying, very worried about what's going to happen, not sure how to do this, but also has no standing, has no way to communicate, doesn't have the data required on the website that they could hand over. And so the first thing I ever did when I was actually just doing fundraising, when I first started, was like, I'm going to set up this thing on the side that like when a threat like that comes in place, a volunteer can just email us and it'll page me and I will call the local police, because I can say I work at the foundation on Wikipedia. We got this thing. I can give you their IP address. I can tell you what we know about the person who made the threat. Can you take a look at that? And then it expanded from there. And we had like, how do you deal with legal things like DMs, like copyright takedowns or subpoenas, but then also how do you deal with people who are problems everywhere, that like they're problems on a lot of different sites, or they're causing such a problem. Maybe they're threatening to kill the person who's blocking them on Wikipedia, like the volunteer. Probably the person who should ban them is not the volunteer, who everybody knows who it is and is relatively public. Maybe the person who's making those death threats, we as the company will block them. We as the company will decide not to allow them on the platform. That removes the liability and the risk off the volunteer. Or maybe we have more information. We know that person's a risk. The volunteer may not know that person's a risk, but we have seen confidential information, or we've seen what they were, like what that they were arrested for something else or what, and can make some of those calls without revealing private information, without putting others at risk at the same time. That could be victims, could be people even just haven't gone to court yet. You don't know what's happening, things like that. And so, yeah, it's a little bit of Supreme Court-y, but it's also trying to protect the users from having to make a lot of those calls at the top end.
Yeah, so you're doing some edge cases, some escalation, some Supreme Court, which basically is what ends up happening for most two-tiered moderation approaches.
Totally. But also writing the policies, the global policies, trying to deal with people who are problems on lots of different sites. May also be in person. There's a lot of in-person events that happen with Wikimedia too.
And Wikimedia's
yeah.
I mean, it's super interesting, right? Because you were the first ones basically dealing with the fake news problem before it was big, and had to somewhat define what a source of truth is before it was a skills problem. I mean, it could be the case that it's not a platform, there's no amplification going on. That in of itself reduces the... go for it.
You could, and that's... But then it gets you into a lot of question of who's amplification, who's the responsible. Like Google and Wikipedia grew alongside each other. And really, like I would argue, and I know some people at Google and some of the founders there would argue too, neither of which, they both needed each other. They were both building at the same time.
Harry Potter, Voldemort type of thing?
Like Wikipedia was getting better. It existed. It was growing. I think it probably had a lot of benefit from happening about starting around the same time there was an economic downturn. So there was a lot of tech people who were out of work, but willing to figure out how to work a wiki, which was not the easiest thing, especially in the start.
Something about economic downturns and creative output. There may not be somehow how this podcast somewhat got going, but maybe not really. Who knows?
But like Google needed to, they wanted things on the top of the, like when somebody made a search, They wanted them to find something that answered the question, and ideally answered the question without somebody making money off of it all the time. So they wanted a nonprofit or a free solution for people to be getting money, because they also knew that people would be queasy about that. They wanted something more trusted, like a news
article. Why would an ask.com or Bing or whatever the Google competitors were? Mm-hmm. Why didn't they thrive off of Wikipedia?
Google was like, those certainly did to a certain degree, but Google was trying to get much better at it. And I think they made a purposeful choice. Wikipedia is a really good place for this to happen. Ask.com and stuff were trying to do it on their platform. They were trying to, let's post things here too, and let's try to figure that out. Google decided Wikipedia might be a good place for a lot of these answers, especially because it's global, it's multilingual, it already was then. They can do it in a lot of places and a lot focused on one thing. And so Wikipedia did very little, essentially nothing, attempting to be SEO friendly. In practice, what happened was the SEO adapted itself to always have Wikipedia on top. And probably if you dug down, that's one of the reasons you have things like, especially
Wikipedia was basically the evaluation set.
Yeah.
Like if Wikipedia gets ranked high, then our algorithm is good.
Exactly.
Interesting. Very interesting. So,
like the old conversations about whether if Elon gets ranked high, therefore the model's going well. The at Twitter, and it's probably where some of the old issues of like lots of links, like lots of interlinks, so links to and from the sites.
But that was for SEO, before, right? The page rank was before Wikipedia, right?
It was similar. It was related. It was around the same time as they were driving to it. But like Wikipedia had a lot of those. Like there was one, was a lot, it was linking to a lot of good source materials because it was using sources and had people looking at that. But also had lots and lots of interlinks and had lots of like connections, because that was just how it was designed. And a lot of that started bleeding into how they were writing, how SEO ended up being needed, and like how the model, what the model was looking for when it was trying to do a search.
I see. Yeah. So I guess one of, probably trying to wrap up around here, but one final question, how are you fact checking so early at Wikipedia then? Like it was, I'm sure there was an intentional choice, such that the design of the platform necessarily led to truth most of the time.
Yeah.
What was the decision making there?
A lot of that comes from, and so like before I worked there, I was a volunteer and still am an admin there and a writer.
I don't write
as much anymore. But a lot of that comes from the volunteers and from like how it was set up and how they enforced it. Like the part of that was a decision that it was an encyclopedia. It was a third party source, which means that you weren't making your own, doing your own investigation. You weren't allowed to be like, this is what it is, source me. That's not allowed. You have to take it from a news source, from an article, from a book, and you have to say where you got that from. How did this come from? And so what it did was it borrowed the understanding and the cred of the other sources. And so it says, hey, we didn't, the way you know this sentence is right is because this came from the New York Times. We wrote it ourselves, but this is, and if it's controversial, maybe we'll have a couple. We'll be like, hey, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Times of London said, this is what it is. Like 1, 2, 3, you can source, you can follow it yourself. And that was always like when people were like, oh, don't use Wikipedia. Like, no, use Wikipedia like you would an encyclopedia. You shouldn't be reading an encyclopedia and sourcing to it too once you're past like sixth grade. Like you should be looking at where it came from and finding sources that talk about it at that first and second degree level. And we are relying on journalists and authors and writers. And it's why Wikipedians love libraries. They love journalists and newspapers. They need it. That's how it's a source using and taking those materials and making sure everything is fact-checked. Just like Twitter and Facebook and others tried to have like fact checks of like it's not that we know it's misinfo, it's everybody else knows it's misinfo. And so it started from the opposite of you need to have a source. If it ends up being wrong, it's because the source was wrong. And then we can remove it there too. And once we discover that a source is bad, if one newspaper is just really bad at checking their own sources, then we say they're not allowed anymore. They're not. They shouldn't be. They shouldn't be sourcing too. But like, and that's why you're relying on their credibility. If their credibility isn't good enough, then you get there. But you want that factual information, not opinion, and not like just state what's there. And if there's conflict, you can have both. Especially, but you want conflict that's like notable enough and important enough. If it's like 60% of people say one thing and 40% say the other, you should have both there. You can say, hey, the majority say, I think it's this, but there's an argument here. But if 5% say one thing and 95% say the other, that 5% should probably get at most a sentence or two. Hey, there's some people who disagree. You can go read it over here. But that's not the consensus and of the experts. So
I wonder if like we can solve all of misinformation by just requiring a source in the like whenever you tweet, you also have to paste a source in.
It works really well with Birdwatch and with community, like now Community Notes or whatever. There is a little bit of that. And, like that's where the commons helps a lot. There's lots and lots of eyes who are like, wait, that doesn't sound right. And they may know, there's a good chance, like most of the people who are trying to fix it, like they know the answer or they have heard the answer. And then what Wikipedia did to try to enforce that is to say now, but you also like, we're not going to take your word for it. You need to get me something I can link to, something I can use as that source. Obviously, you eventually need experts. Somebody needed to write that source. And so the important thing is to always still have that. Still have people who are doing the research, who are making those decisions.
If you look at the internet now, like the Wikipedia was a miracle. There's so many ways it could have gone wrong.
Oh yeah,
it could have turned into just a bunch of 14-year-old boys, which is one of the biggest attack vectors in integrity. If we're being real, just like completely shitposting. Reddit's also community moderated, but not Reddit. Yeah, Reddit is also community moderated, but. Nothing like making an encyclopedia together.
Everybody has every company that does really well and every website that does really well involves a lot of skill and doing the right thing, but also a lot of luck. And it's important to remember as you're founding companies. It's important to remember as you're creating new content. Look at TikTok right now. Look at Vine. TikTok. No,
But that's not fair, right? After Vine, you could have said that something TikTok was going to happen at some point. It was a matter of when video storage would get at that point. Because Vine was 7 seconds, and people loved it.
It did. Yeah. But a lot of it is also just like hitting the right thing
at the right time.
At the right time, who has the right like content? Like, arguably, we probably had the right technology to do TikTok and Vine. It just wasn't what was the focus and what was the decision of how that worked. And like we saw with Musical.ly that really how it could get to TikTok the same reasons. And like and then they merged, and so it is the same thing now. There's always a bit of just the time.
Okay. Anyways, cool. James, always fun chatting with you. Thanks for coming on the show, and welcome back in the future.
Definitely. Thanks so much.
See ya.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please share this episode with your friends to help us make more episodes for you. This episode was hosted and produced by Talha Baig, with help from myself, Jacob Morse. Music was by Zhihao Shen, and special thanks to Rachel, Sean, Cass, and Sahar for their continued support.